The task I've been given is to address the issue of challenges to biological evolution. Now, I have to warn you, I'm not a very good conformist. Therefore, when people give me something to conform to, like a subject, I don't do it very well. And the reason I'm not going to do this one terribly well is because I am not an anti-evolutionist. I am a creationist. And there is a distinct difference. I am not attempting to attack or destroy evolution. I am interested in understanding the world in the light of creation. So you're going to see probably a very different throw on this issue of the challenges to biological evolution from a creationist as opposed to an anti-evolutionist. And in order to do this, I think it's fair that I define what I'm going to consider a challenge and what I'm going to consider adequate challenge to evolution in order to consider alternatives. What would be an adequate challenge to biological evolution? What's my standard? And here I'm going to go to John chapter 2, a familiar passage to probably even many unbelievers. But the situation is that we're in the small town of Cana in Galilee. There's a wedding going on, a wedding feast going on. 3 days into that feast, the wine runs out. And Jesus is confronted with the absence of wine. At first, he doesn't do anything about it. He sort of pushes off the issue. But then, of course, he tells the servants of the feast to fill up some water pots. Then he tells them to take the fluid from those water pots and take it to what the King James Version calls the governor of the feast. And I'm going to call that dude governor. Okay, just he's the governor. And when they take it to the governor, there's an interesting parenthetical note in the Bible there. It says as they passed it to him, they didn't tell him where it came from. So he's lacking some information. Like where in the world this material came from. He takes it and goes, "Woo, good stuff," and then proceeds to commend the governor of the bridegroom of the feast for having reserved this wine till later. Now I want to consider what might have been going on inside the governor's head implicitly, and if we were standing there and asked him such a thing as, "Where do you think that wine came from?" He probably would have come up with what I'm going to call the governor's hypothesis about the origin of the wine. First of all, the wine was grape derived. He would have said, "Well, of course, you know, grapes were grown on vines. The grapes were then harvested by humans. They were processed in some way or another." And if you asked him about the age of it, he would have said, "Well, of course, the wine is rather old. It's at least 3 days old." Because he said that even when he commended the bridegroom. You've had it there for at least three days. Now, a few comments about this hypothesis. This hypothesis, first of all, is very reasonable. Any one of us would have concluded very much the same thing. There is nothing unreasonable about the hypothesis. Secondly, it is reproducible. You could create wine by this process that would be similar to the wine that he was ingesting. So you can actually reproduce the product in some experimental manner. It's also, of course, the hypothesis is arrived at by human reason and human experience. Human experience brought him to the conclusion that it came from grapes and processed and so on and so forth. And it was human reason which led him to the conclusion that that's the process whereby the wine came to be. It's also that this is a familiar process to him. He was appealing to known events, known processes in his experience. And also, there's evidence here. Part of it could be in the reproducibility. But I bet if you picked up this wine and did scientific experiments on it, you would see evidence in the wine of things that seem to come from grapes. of things that seem to come from the various elements in the process of development of the wine. If it's fermented, which seems implied in the text, then there's evidence that you've got fermented products produced by microorganisms, and the evidence seems to be within the wine. So there's evidence of this particular for this particular hypothesis, but of course it's completely wrong. Whoops. Fascinating. We have a reasonable, reproducible, human-derived, familiar, evidenced hypothesis that is wholly wrong. Cool. Now, the true hypothesis, which is that Jesus created it, differs in that it's the wine is not grape-derived, doesn't come from grapes originally. It is God-created, not human-harvested. It is not processed at all. It is directly created by fiat, and of course it's very young. And this hypothesis, the true hypothesis, from the point of view of a person who does not know Jesus and Jesus' power, is actually an unreasonable hypothesis. You've got to be kidding. He made that? Yeah, right. It's unreasonable. And it is not reproducible. Humans cannot reproduce what Jesus did. They might be able to get the same product, but not by the same process. It's also revelation-derived. You would get the information from revelation. We do. We get the information from the revelation of Scripture and not from human reason and not from human experience. Now, if we saw enough wine created in front of us, we might get it from human experience, but that sort of thing just doesn't happen very often. It's an unfamiliar process to humans. And there's not evidence for it, at least other than the eyewitness evidence that was there. There is no physical evidence that, in fact, that's how things came to be. But, of course, it's got the advantage of being right. Now, we know this about the Cana wine situation, that governor's hypothesis, again, going back to that, let's generalize this to evolutionary hypotheses. In general, things are, rather than grape-derived, generalizing it, they are derived from pre-existent things. Here's the evolutionary hypothesis, that things that are derived from things that already were. Two, they are developed through natural process, analogous to the human harvesting and that sort of thing. The assumption is that things, according to evolution, are derived from pre-existing things and developed through natural processes which we are familiar with. And it turns out that once you postulate that those natural processes brought them into existence, you're stuck with having to conclude that they are very old because those processes take time. Now, this kind of hypothesis is, I would maintain, extremely reasonable. It is also it's also within human experience. You're appealing to natural laws and processes that humans are familiar with. It is reproducible because natural processes are involved, and we can many times reproduce natural processes unnaturally. And we have physical evidence very often for these events. It is human-derived, and I would suggest it's wrong. In contrast, the creationary hypothesis makes the claim that that which is ultimately not derived from pre-existent things. It is not developed through natural process. It's created by fiat creation, and the biblical claim is that things are young. This hypothesis, I would suggest, within the experience of human beings and outside of the knowledge of God and a faith in God, is a highly unreasonable hypothesis. You've got to be kidding. He created the universe, and, you know, just like that, with speaking a word? Oh, come on. It's outside of any of our experiences. The origin of these things is wholly unfamiliar to us. It is not reproducible. We cannot recreate things the way God created them. We might be able to produce the same kind of effect, But we use a process which was not involved in the origin of those things. It is not necessarily physically evidenced. It is revelation derived, but of course it's got the advantage of being right. Now, with this having been said, how can you blame the governor of the feast or condemn the governor of the feast for having come to the wrong conclusion? Can you really say that, given it's so reasonable and all of that stuff, so what's wrong? Why don't you let the guy go and allow him the right to be wrong? What's the problem? Well, I would suggest that God made the governor accountable for his conclusion. Therefore, the governor is actually to be blamed for coming to the wrong conclusion, regardless of the fact that it's reasonable and all of that. And here's why I say that. Because God himself, Jesus, provided evidence against the governor's hypothesis. For example, I suggest that the wine's perfection, I think the wine was perfect. I don't know what in the world perfect wine is, but if you were able to do scientific experiments on the wine, and you knew what perfect wine was, that wine would have been perfect. And no other wine would come close to that. Therefore, there is evidence in the very nature of the wine itself that had been created by the hand of God. God placed evidence of his creation within the wine, so much so that 3 days into the feast, and the governor himself says, hey, after 3 days, you know, you bring out the poor wine because people really don't care anymore, you know. And here it is 3 days into the feast when the governor shouldn't care anymore, and he goes, woo, it woke him up. It's like, this was so good, it even made an impression upon him 3 days into the feast. That's impressive. I would suggest also, he mentioned something else. Not only did he mention that it was good wine, but he also mentioned the fact to the bridegroom that, you know, I've been, implicitly, I'm putting a few words in here, I've been to a few of these things before. And at those that I've been at before, what they do is they bring out the good wine at first, and then 3 days later, when it doesn't make any difference anymore, they bring out the poor wine. And you've broken tradition. And he commends them for breaking tradition. Of course, breaking tradition is not a big thing to the Hebrews, right? Fiddler on the Roof. The break in tradition is significant. And it was so significant that the governor acknowledged it and made public acclamation of its importance. So I would suggest these are two evidences against his hypothesis, suggesting something's not quite right with this hypothesis that the wine has been there for 3 days. It shouldn't have been against tradition. It should have been against reason. I put in another one here. I think maybe this is more a reflection of my evil, the inherent evil of my flesh. But if I was in the bridegroom's situation and I had run out of wine, but maybe I wouldn't have been in my right mind by that point, but I had run out of the wine that I had prepared for the feast, and all I had left was this precious, really good stuff, you know, I wouldn't serve it. I'd grab one of those flagons and give it to my servant and say, go down to the market, trade it for 15 really the worst wine you can find, and bring it back, and we'll serve that. I'm not going to use all my good wine. I'm going to trade it. It's sort of stupid to do what the bridegroom did under the circumstances, if in fact the governor's hypothesis is correct. So I suggest that it's actually against reason. There's something not quite right with this hypothesis. I'd suggest also that if he had seen where the wine came from, those pots of water, that would have been evidence, too, against this hypothesis. I would suggest none of these things proves that the wine was not produced in this way. But every one of them is sort of like a little burr, a little thorn under the saddle that suggests that the hypothesis is not right and should have then caused him to do what? To say, whoo, where did this come from? To go to These, by the way, are all anomalies. He should have been, by these anomalies, prompted to ask the eyewitnesses that Jesus sent to his very feet. I mean, that's incredible. Jesus sent the eyewitness testimony to his very feet. And it would have been easy for him to say, "Where'd you get this?" And he wouldn't have come to the wrong conclusion at all. Therefore, I suggest in ignoring the anomalies and thus not turning to the eyewitness testimony, he is guilty of incorrect reasoning. Even though his hypothesis is reasonable, evidenced, and all of that stuff, that God made sure that there was plenty of physical evidence to suggest his idea was wrong, and then thus to cause him to turn to eyewitness testimony. I would suggest that this is generalizable. How can scientists be blamed for coming to the wrong conclusion when their hypotheses are reasonable, well-evidenced, blah, 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 blah? It's because I believe God has created the universe in such a way that there is always evidence against every hypothesis. There are anomalies that God has built into this universe. He has created this universe. This is an incredible thought. But he has created this universe before time began. I know that doesn't make any sense. In one sense, you can't be before time, when, you know, but you know what I mean. That when there was no creation, he conceived of a creation, anticipating every single alternate theory of origins that humans would ever devise, and created a universe that would always, every day, for all the duration of the universe, stand, there would be evidence standing in direct contradiction to the false creation myths humans would devise, including evolution, but every other creation myth humans have come up with through time. God created the entire universe as a polemic against man-derived ideas. God created the universe as a polemic against every false idea of man. And that evidence, which I believe he's put under the burr under the saddle, and every scientist knows it. Every scientist knows that every theory they've ever produced doesn't quite fit all of the data. That's why science is continually wrong. That's why science is continually changing its theories. There's always that irritation that you can't find the theory that explains everything. The tow theory, the theory of everything, eludes us all. And there's a reason for that. There are two reasons. One of them is, for the unbeliever, it is a continual burr under the saddle to suggest that their ideas are wrong. And I'll get to the reason why it's also true of creationist theories a little bit later. This evidence which God has put into the universe, these anomalies, should be causing us to turn to the eyewitness testimony, which is what? The Bible. The only one there was God himself. And he provided the eyewitness testimony. He sent it to us. He gave it to us. He transcribed it. Cool stuff. Okay, just like he sent the eyewitnesses to the governor of the feast, so likewise, he's given the eyewitness testimony to the world. By the way, it's the responsibility of the believers to share that eyewitness testimony. And that's all you have to do. Don't worry about all the blasted arguments for creation and evolution and all of that stuff. Just share the eyewitness testimony. God has provided the anomalies that should be sufficient to cause people to turn to the eyewitness testimony. Okay, let's go quickly, briefly, through some of the theories of science, the evolutionary theories, for me to show you some of the anomalies that exist. I'm going to go through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Four categories of evolutionary theories, and provide 5 anomalies in each category. But this is not even hardly scraping the surface off of these things. There is so much more that we could do. In the area of evolutionary astronomy theories, this would include theories of evolution describing the origin of the universe, the origin of galaxies, the origin of stars, the origin of the solar system, the origin of the Earth and the Sun, all of those kinds of theories. It includes the Big Bang theory, which is popular now for the origin of the universe, the congregation-aggregation hypothesis for the origin of the solar system, and so on. What kind of challenges or anomalies exist in those areas? One is, and some of these are not necessarily physical evidences or physical anomalies, just like there was one of the anomalies, I think, that stood before the governor of the feast was the unreasonableness of somebody actually serving the good wine late in the feast. So some of these are actually anomalies of reason. And it's long been a sort of a burr under many people's saddle how to explain the origin of the universe itself from the non-universe. How do you do that? It seems like something in the human psyche kind of resists the idea of having anything come from nothing, and to have everything come from nothing is even more repulsive. You know, the entire universe to come from nothing. Oh. Now, there are some people, they don't let that bother them. But I think many people in the world are in fact bothered, and many unbelievers who in fact believe in the Big Bang Theory do struggle with this a bit. Not everyone, because most of those who hold to these ideas, probably like the governor of the feast, have rejected these burrs and have refused to turn to the eyewitness testimony. Romans 1:21, they knew God. When they knew God, they glorified him not as God, but became vain in their imaginations. Professing themselves to become wise, they became fools. Later, changed the glory of God into the creation, and so on and so forth. Secondly, there is this funny principle in the universe that's been called the anthropic principle, or anthropic cosmological principle, or the cosmological anthropic principle. It's got a variety of names. What's fascinating about this one is that it's devised by unbelievers. Unbelievers recognized, beginning in the 1940s, there's some interesting coincidences in the universe. The first coincidence that was observed was that there was a number that kept coming up, 10 to the 40th. That's a big number. One with 40 zeros behind it. Now, when you're talking about big numbers like that, you can obviously mean any number between 0 and something in excess of 10 to the 40th. Lots of possible numbers that you can be playing with. How in the world do you keep coming up with 10 to the 40th? And it came up in a variety of places that seemed completely unrelated to one another. That's curious. Why do such numbers keep coming up? Well, that sort of spawned a curiosity. There's a burr under the saddle, in a sense. A curiosity that caused scientists to begin to look for other coincidences. Are there others? And subsequently, they realized that there were many, and there became a cascade of coincidences. And ultimately, this category of coincidences was put under or labeled the anthropic principle, because when you looked at the variety of the coincidences, a lot of them seem to be there as if the universe was designed for man. Of course, it isn't, you know that. Right? But it looked like the universe, if you just took the simple interpretation of the data, it kind of looked like the universe was designed for man. And so that was why it was called anthropic, derived from human. The human principle. The human principle of the universe. It looks like the universe was designed for man. The regularity of laws, the very special kind of laws, the fine-tuning of the universe to make sure that life could exist, and so on and so forth. And now there are some people who would say, that's so silly. If the universe was not fine-tuned for man, man wouldn't be here to observe it. So obviously, the universe is going to look like it was made for us, in retrospect. But the neat thing about the anthropic principle is there's a bunch of those coincidences that don't have to be there for life to exist or for humans to exist. There are some things that are just awfully nice that they are there. For example, the fact that we just happen to have a brain complex enough to understand the simplicity of the universe as it now exists. The evolution of humans just happened to come up to the exact point where it needs to be to understand the complexity of the universe as it was decreasing in complexity from the beginning. We've met. Yeehaw! The correspondence between mathematics, a human-derived language, and the nature of the universe. Why should it be that a human-derived language should correspond so closely to the universe? Whoa! That's mind-boggling. This isn't necessary for our survival. This isn't necessary for the survival of life, but it sure is nice, and it kind of looks like the universe was put there for us to understand. So the anthropic principle sits as a little bit of a burr under the saddle of those who would suggest that the universe came into being without supernatural guidance or without supernatural creation. Background radiation too uniform. This is specifically for the Big Bang Theory. The Big Bang Theory postulated that there should be radiation coming at us from all directions. It should be following the black body spectrum. And it should be close to the black body spectrum, but only as close as the universe is uniform. It's got to reflect the uniformity of the universe. See, the universe isn't completely uniform, thankfully. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. If the universe was uniform, our stuff would be spread through the universe. And the fact that we're all scrunched together here in highly improbable, in tropic improbabilities is because the universe's matter is clumped and all of that sort of thing. And so the background radiation's got to reflect the clumpiness of matter in the universe. Let's put it that way. And so it should reflect it at about one point in 10,000, as was the original estimate. But when the COBE satellite went up there and started measuring the background radiation, it was every time it went around, it got better and better. It is good to one part in 10, one part in 100, one part in 1,000. You know, starting to celebrate. One part in 10,000. Yeehaw! We did it! One part in 100,000. Wait a minute. Hold it. A little bit too uniform here. So the universe's background radiation seems to be too uniform for the clumpiness of matter distribution, which is a bit of a burr. Big Bang Theory is a wonderful, reasonable theory, well-evidenced, explains a lot, but there's these little things that keep bothering us. The origin of order itself. Once the universe came into being, once the laws of this universe are extant, like the law of second law of thermodynamics, where although the total amount of energy, once the energy has been produced in the universe, however that happens, point number one there, once it is there, we got a problem in our observation that energy doesn't change in total quantity, but its usefulness decreases through time. There's less and less of it used. One of the corollaries of this is that the total, I'll say clumpiness would be an example. The total clumpiness of the universe is going to decrease. The total complexity of the universe is going to decrease. The universe should be more or less decreasing in complexity through time. We have a fairly complex universe as it now exists. And you know, we have fairly complex brains and stuff like that sitting in the universe. And this suggests, the second law of thermodynamics suggests the universe probably was more complex in the past rather than less. And so the question is, where did that original complexity come from? How did you get it? Because there is no natural law we know of that can generate that kind of complexity. So you have to go back to this first, this something from nothing. And you actually have to postulate that there was more complexity in the original universe than there is now. So not only do you have to explain something from nothing, but you have to explain more than something from nothing. More than what is now from nothing. And that really, that's a bit of a bear. The diversity of planetary bodies getting down to the solar system level. The solar system is a beautiful place. As long as you're protected. You go through, he's taken these pictures of these planets, every planet being different, beautiful in its own right, astonishing differences. There are similarities. There are similarities which go along with the idea and are consistent with the idea that the solar system condensed out of the same cloud the sun did. But then there are those differences. Very difficult to explain why in the world Venus is going the wrong direction, and why the composition, why it appears that Uranus has got a core that's off center, and it goes on and on. There's just these perturbing differences that seem disturbing, that just they're hard to explain. None of these things are sufficient to prove the evolutionary hypothesis wrong, but there's sufficient burrs under the saddle to suggest that something isn't quite right. Now, I'm going to have to go through this quickly because this is Steve's area, and I don't want to take Steve's thunder away. But in the area of evolutionary geology theories, the evolution of the Earth, the evolution of mountains, the evolution of oceans, continents, all of that sort of thing, we have a number of challenges here, and I'll just go quickly through them. There is evidence that the magnetic field is decaying rather rapidly and that reversals can occur very quickly, and both of those are contrary to the evolutionary claims about the origin and history of the Earth's magnetic field. Real problematic. There is, for example, a problem with minerals in mountains which are actually high pressure but low temperature minerals. Now you can imagine mountains, if they're crunching mountains, if they're mountains formed by crunching two continents together, it's pretty easy to get high pressure in those mountains. But in the conventional understanding of the evolution of mountains, in order to get that high pressure, you've actually got to bury this rock way down deep so that the mass of the rock above produces the pressure necessary to produce certain minerals. You see, by the way, I should say, there are certain minerals which can only be produced under high pressure as opposed to low pressure. So that pressure is produced by burying it significantly deeply. But if you do that on evolutionary timescales, on conventional timescales, it takes a long time to get it down there and a long time to get it back up again. And in the process, it's going to heat up because as you get deeper and deeper, it gets warmer and warmer. So you should, when you find high-pressure minerals, also find those minerals are high temperature. You would not expect high-pressure, low-temperature minerals. And we keep running into these high-pressure, low-temperature minerals as if the pressure was achieved by a burial or crunching very quickly and relieved of it, in other words, stuff was eroded off the top of it, too quickly for it to warm up. And that doesn't fit conventional timescales. Phanerozoic long temperature trends. When you look at oxygen isotope ratios in the fossil record, which are a proxy or an indication of the temperature of at the time of deposition, or in fact at the time of growth of the little critters. We're talking about marine organisms that are floating around, short generation time marine organisms that are floating around in the ocean. And they pick up oxygen, carbon dioxide from the water. And the ratio of isotopes is a fairly good indication of, among other things, the temperature of the environment. Well, from the first time that we have abundant animals in the fossil record, all the way through the fossil record, there is a change in temperature. It's kind of interesting. If you look at the oxygen isotope ratios, there's a consistent change from the very oldest animals to an increase in temperature all the way up to the Cretaceous, and then a drop in temperature towards the present. Now, this is in conventional timescales, this is 450 million years of temperature increase, and then 70 million years of temperature decrease. And there's no explanation for this in conventional wisdom. Why is the Earth warming up 20 degrees centigrade for tens of millions of years, and then cooling over tens of millions of years. And this is a little bit, it challenges the idea, perhaps both the idea that we have an understanding of the history of the Earth and that perhaps we have an understanding of the time chronologue of the Earth. Also, the widespread, thick, uniform sediment spread across continents, Steve's going to talk about this, it's very difficult to explain in conventional geologic wisdom. Also, global patterns, patterns that you see on a global scale that suggest global sedimentation events rather than just local things like it's happening today, as if something happened in the past that is not being experienced today. But again, these are just anomalies. These are not sufficient evidence to argue against the evolutionary hypotheses of geology. They're burrs under the saddle. Evolutionary biology theories. I finally got some what I've been assigned to do. I told you I wasn't going to obey very well. Here, for example, we have the observation of interspecific hybridization. According to conventional theory, of course, organisms diversify, they create new species over very long periods of time, millions and millions of years. So that when you look at something like the anatids, which are the ducks, swans, and geese, we have 100 and some species of ducks, swans, and geese in the world. And they are supposed to have evolved from a single common ancestral duck or swan or goose, probably a duck. And that diversification, that creation of species, occurred over probably tens of millions of years, because we have fossils of these critters going back, and they conventionally date them as tens of millions of years. That's the conventional wisdom on the origin of the ducks, swans, and geese. Well, if you have had separate species for millions of years, even a million years, but certainly millions and then tens of millions of years, then the likelihood that they would be able to still interbreed seems like zero. In fact, it's a little less than zero. But the problem is that 80% of the anatid species have been crossed successfully with other species in the anatid family. And 40% of the genera have been successfully crossed with other genera. And of the 11 subfamilies, all of those with membership greater than 3, which means it's probably a statistical issue, have members, 7 of them, have members that can breed with other subfamilies. So it appears that and we haven't tried all of them, all the combinations. So it appears that all the ducks and swans and geese still have the ability. Have you ever gone down to the park and there's one down at the base of the hill at Bryan. There is one. I probably shouldn't say ugly duck, but it really is. I mean, I just can't. I can't resist. That is yuck. It's like 3 different duck types all mixed together in this bizarre critter. And besides, the fisherman put he grabbed up a fish hook and it ripped out his bill. So he's even weirder than that. But that's obviously not genetic. The anatids appear to still be capable of interbreeding across the entire family. But that's also true of the horses. 7 species of horses, including the zebra and the donkey and the horse, all combinations produce offspring. And it's only the mule that is infertile. But even the mule is fertile in one out of 1,000 cases. And a couple of years ago, they successfully crossed a llama and a camel for a comma. And of course, you've heard of ligers, lions and tigers crossing. It appears as if, in our studies, that interspecific hybridization is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Now, this doesn't make sense. If species have been around for a very long period of time. A little bit of a burr under the saddle. By the way, and this is a little burr under my saddle too, because, and I'll have to get this off my chest. I went through undergraduate education being 2 courses shy of a double major in biology and geology. I didn't want to take social science, another social science course, and a music course. And so I didn't major in biology. I majored in geology, because you didn't have to do that in geology. But I took the biology major. And then at Harvard, half of my courses were biology courses, including a course on how to define a species. Can you imagine? And they never told me this. I never knew about this. There are books written on this, and no one ever even gave me the slightest clue that interspecific hybridization was ubiquitous in the world. When I learned this, I was angry. Sorry, I had to get that on. Also, there is ubiquitous, widespread homoplasy. Now we can go on to the rest, next one, right? You know what that is. Let's see. How do I explain this best? According to evolutionary theory, biological evolutionary theory, all organisms are descended from a common ancestral organism. And you can picture it with the evolutionary tree. The analogy that Darwin introduced was the idea of a tree. You got the single species that everything evolved from is represented by the stump. And then it evolved into two different species. That's the branch, first major trunk branch. And then it evolved into two more and blah, 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 blah. And you produce the branching of the tree so that the tips of the branches represent the modern species. And the branches themselves represent the history, the evolutionary history. Now, you know something about trees. It isn't common. It does occur. But it isn't common, bless you, that, in fact, the branches on a tree anastomose, which is to say, they usually branch and they never come back together again. They don't come back and now they're, the strangler fig is an exception. You know, there are a few things like that that are exceptions, but for the most part, the typical tree that we as kids drew was one which was a bifurcating, non-anastomosing, you didn't know it was that complicated, did you? A tree structure. Evolution suggests that that's the history of life. That to argue that a species, once it diverges, comes back together again, or that two species, once diverge, will re-evolve back to a common species, or that there will be crossing across the branches, that you'll be able to throw your information, your genetic information, across to another branch, that's a no-no in evolution. Homoplasies are situations when you draw the hypothetical tree. Homoplasies are characters that join branches. In other words, anastomosing branches. There is evidence that there are similarities across species, genera, phyla, that shouldn't be there if evolution is true. My favorite example is the gene in humans that precipitates the generation of the human eye in development. This is one gene that turns on several other genes, which turn on several other genes, that start what we call the cascade in the development of the human eye early in embryogenesis. Okay? Now, this is what humans do. They pick the human gene that does that, and they stick it in a fly wing. Let's not ask about the ethics here. Let's just observation. What happens when the fly is developing? It's before the wing is generated. They put it in that portion of the fly that's going to generate the wing. And you know what happens? A fly eye develops on the wing. The same gene that precipitates eye development in humans precipitates eye development in flies. Say so what? According to evolution, eyes in insects and eyes in vertebrates, us, did not come from a single common ancestor. We did not inherit eyes from a branch that we had in common. So those two eyes, human and a fly eyes, are independently evolved. How did you first of all, evolve an eye more than once. By the way, it happened more than 40 times in the history of life, according to evolution. But not only do you have to evolve it more than once, but you actually evolve this same gene to precipitate it in two completely different groups. Suggests that they're trading information or something. They call it now lateral gene transfer, which is becoming more and more common, because there's abundant and ubiquitous homoplasy. For every three characters you look at, there will be one of them that displays homoplasy, which suggests that the branches of the tree are connected and interconnected and... So what is the history of life? It suggests there's something wrong with the evolutionary tree. Too few stratomorphic intermediates. A stratomorphic intermediate is a fossil that is in the right stratigraphic level and the right morphological position. A morphological intermediate would be a critter that looks kind of like a mixture between two organisms. Duck-billed platypus might be a morphological intermediate. I mean, when the first duck-billed platypus skin came to the British Museum, the people at the British Museum thought people were playing tricks on them, and they had sewn a bill onto a mammal. Forget the egg-laying stuff. They didn't know about the eggs. That would have really blown their... But it looks like kind of an intermediate, a strange sort of intermediate, morphological, between mammals and birds. Now, fortunately, evolution doesn't postulate that mammals evolve from birds, so you'll never hear the platypus put up as an intermediate between the two. But it sure does kind of look like it's a morphological intermediate. A stratigraphic intermediate is an organism that is sitting in the fossil record between two other organisms. If you have an organism that is both morphologically between two organisms and stratigraphically in the record, that's what you would expect if evolution is true. If you think that A evolved into B through C, you would expect C would be between A and B in the fossil record. That's what you would expect. That's what I call a stratomorphic intermediate. I don't like calling it transitional form because that's an interpretive term. That's an evolutionary term. Stratomorphic intermediate just describes what it looks like in its position. You would expect a lot of stratomorphic intermediates if evolution is true. There are things that are stratomorphic intermediates in the fossil record, but they seem to be far too few of them for evolutionary theory. For example, among the invertebrates, and I'm strictly speaking an invertebrate paleontologist studying invertebrates, there are no stratomorphic intermediates that I know of in the fossil record between major groups. And that's most of the fossil record. 95% of the fossil record is shallow marine invertebrate animals. And there's no stratomorphic intermediates. This is disturbing for those that believe that evolution is true. The origin of complexity, somewhat similar to the burr that we ran into in astronomy, but in this case, it's a million times worse or a billion times worse because the complexity of organic matter of living organisms is mind-boggling. It is really amazing, and it's a complexity on every level. From the organelles within cells, to the complexity among the cells, to the complexity among the tissues, to the complexity among the organs, to the complexity among the systems in our body, to the complexity of our bodies, to the complexity of species within ecosystems, to the complexity of ecosystems within the entire biota. The complexity at every level is stunning. And then all those levels have got to interact with each other. So there's got to be an extraordinary integration of complexity. It's terribly complex. And in our experience, that kind of complexity just doesn't spontaneously arise. It's just unnervingly complex for those that would suggest that natural processes came and brought it into being. Also, I like to look at the over-design. Most people focus on the design of organisms, but you know, things are actually over-designed. Our brain's too big for survival. It's bigger than it needs to be. There are more species than there need to be. There are more organs in your body than there need to be, transplants being evidence thereof. There are more. You are over-designed. This entire creation is over-designed. Look at the beauty which is there and doesn't have to be there for survival. In evolutionary theory, you don't invest energy into the unnecessary. You'll be eliminated by organisms that are not doing the unnecessary and not having to eat as much. Okay? You're not going to over-design. You're going to come up to design, but you're not going to over-design. So the over-design of biology is a real burr under the saddle. Evolutionary anthropology theories. Again, those are anomalies that are not proof that biological evolution is wrong, merely burrs under the saddle. The recent origin of human DNA. In studying looking at the differences among the DNA found in humans across the entire planet. If all humans came from, let's say, an original pair of humans, some point along the line, no matter who you are, you're going to believe that's the case, then once they diverged and never crossed again, they're each going to accumulate mutations independently, and so the longer they've been apart, the more mutations they'll have, different from each other. So you should be able to look at the modern humans and look at the total number of mutations that are found between and among all humans and determine how long it's been since there was a single common ancestor. And they can do that. They can do that to go back to the mother of all living by using mitochondrial DNA, because your mitochondria only come from your mom. So you can look at the DNA and figure out how long it's been since all humans came from a single female. Well, married, but you know what I mean. And then you can look at the Y chromosomes, which, guys, we hope come from our fathers. And so we can look at the Y chromosomes in humans across the world and determine how long it's been since all the humans had a male ancestor. And the figures you get in the female end of things it tends to a couple hundred thousand years. In the male sense, there's actually no difference in the region of the Y chromosome that they've studied, so it can be anywhere from 0 to about 20,000 years. Somewhere in that range is how far back humans had a common ancestor. But the problem with that is that we have fossils that are supposedly dated at hundreds of thousands and millions of years. And so how in the world do you reconcile those two problems? It appears that there is DNA evidence that humans have a recent origin from a pair. The brain is over-designed. I've mentioned that. The monotheism of early Chinese. According to evolutionary theory of religion, polytheism, you evolve sort of from animism to polytheism to monotheism as a final end result. But there is evidence in the early Chinese writing found in bones, scribbled on bones back 4,000 years ago, that the original Chinese religion at the time of the establishment of China was actually biblical. It's monotheistic. The story of creation, it's the work of Ethel Nelson and others in Chinese culture. Amazing stuff. But this is a little bit of a problem for those that would suggest that the Chinese came from polytheism. Also, the observation that languages seem underivable from one another. There are basic language groups. According to evolution, the languages would have evolved from a single common ancestral language, but there appear to be major language groups which are underivable from one another. They appear to arise rather rapidly, independently, as if there's some other origin of those languages. Related to this is the rapid origin of advanced culture. We find advanced cultures appearing on the scene very quickly in Egypt, Mesopotamia, the Indus River Valley, China, and there's not a lot of time between these events either. It appears that diverse cultures, appear in multiple places very quickly without that development that you would expect to see in culture according to evolutionary theory. I would suggest that these things should provide cause for pause to consider the Creator's claims. And I would further suggest, generalizing, that all human theories, creationist or evolutionist theories, have been provided with anomalies. There are anomalies not only for every evolutionary theory, there are anomalies for every creationist theory. Because I believe God has withheld proof. Now, this is interesting. It's a two-sided coin. On the one side of the coin, he's provided burrs against all attempts by humans to explain the origin of things. And I suggest on the other side of the same coin, he has made sure that it is impossible to derive proof for anything. He has withheld proof of his existence. He has withheld proof of creation. He has withheld proof of all of those things because it requires faith. Hebrews 11:3. It is by faith that we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God. If it was possible to prove it by the mind or by evidence or in any other way, faith would not be required. But all that God is pleased with is faith. That is the only thing that pleases God. So he makes sure that you cannot believe without faith. He provides anomalies for every theory. The unbeliever's theories going against the claims of God and the believer's theories coincident with the claims of God. What's wrong with evolution is not that it's unreasonable, because I think it is reasonable. It's not that it's poorly evidenced, because I think it is strongly evidenced. It is not that it's falsified. It's not even that it's wrong, even though I think it is. The main problem with evolution is that it's impossible to please God without faith. And if, in fact, you rely upon any of the thinkings of man, whether it creationist or evolutionist, to believe anything about the origin of things, then you are not pleasing God. You must believe in order to please God. Through faith we understand that the world was framed by the Word of God. The most important thing then is not that you're a creationist or an evolutionist, but it's that you rely on God alone. That you rely on His claims alone, and not human reason, not human experience, not human evidences, not reasonable theories, but in fact the Word of God. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father except by me. You can't get there by creation. You can't get there by evolution. You can't get there by science. You can't get there by reason. You can't get there by philosophy. Only by Jesus Christ. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. There's nothing more important than what God has done for you and for me. He has laid his life down so that you and I can have a relationship with him. Far, far more important than the issue of creation and evolution is our relationship to God. Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and thou shalt be saved. He loves you. He even loves me. He died for me, and he died for you, so that you can live with him forever. Friend, if you don't know Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, I would love for you to come to know him today. Talk to me. Talk to the pastor about how you can believe in the name of Jesus Christ. Thank you.